ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Data centres are not digging anything up. They're not exploiting resources that are owned by the Australian people, but they certainly shouldn't be getting concessional prices for the electricity they use.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri Country in Melbourne.
And I'm Melissa Clark, joining you from Ngunnawal Country and recognising other custodians. I'm here in our Parliament House studios in Canberra.
And Mel, we're going to get into some of the excellent questions from our listeners in this special Question Time edition of The Party Room. And there are some excellent questions today. But first, I just want to issue a correction on remarks made on yesterday's Party Room episode. Fran said that journalist Margot Kingston was granted exclusive access to the 1996 election night. That was inaccurate. She actually, Margot Kingston, this is, was not there. Margot Kingston has long lobbied for journalists to be granted access to politicians and for a free and fair press, i.e. that everyone should be able to go and ask questions and be part of that. She's a legend of journalism and we apologise for getting that wrong. The broader context, though, I think is important. We're actually trying to say a good thing about Margot, but it got fumbled, which is that she was really onto this One Nation story, documenting it, watching it and taking an interest, not to the detriment of other journalists, but because she was investing in it. So just want to correct the record and very happy that she's also a keen listener of our show. Mel, we must, before we get to the questions, share some political developments with our listeners, because Richard Miles has been a bit busy, hasn't he? He's been
really
acting Prime Minister, or just finishing that little stint.
He's wrapped up now, but he has had a couple of days as acting Prime Minister, and it's fair to say it's been an eventful couple of days. So I think the key thing that has happened, of course, through this week has been that cabinet meeting that was at the start of the week, where the plans for a change to immigration policy were delayed or deferred. And ever since then, we've been trying to get to the bottom of precisely what happened and what unfolded in that cabinet meeting. Now, the latest reports that we've seen in the Financial Review describe the leadership group within Cabinet. So these are the most senior members within Cabinet, obviously absent Anthony Albanese because he's been on holiday. So that means Richard Miles has been, as acting Prime Minister, is the leader of that leadership group within Cabinet, that it was them who vetoed the new immigration policy from going ahead. And that's what's prompted Tony Burke to delay his speech to the National Press Club. So now Richard Miles was pressed on this on Radio National Breakfast. He was very keen to say that those reports are not right, but of course didn't want to say what was right because that would be breaching, you know, cabinet confidentialities. But he did go to some lengths to try and say that report was not right, and was also, curiously, I thought, PK, quite keen to emphasise that Tony Burke didn't cancel his speech, that it was just postponed. He seemed very frustrated that it was being described as cancelled. So I think what we're seeing is Richard Miles trying to shift the explanation of what's going on here, but he's not actually delivering the information about what did go on. So I'm not sure we're any the wiser at this point, are we?
No, but I do have some more mail that's worth sharing. Okay, so the decision by Tony Burke to postpone, okay, that is officially true, although that particular date was cancelled, that's also true. So, you know, depends how you want to describe
it. A lot of semantics exactly here. The speech was going to happen. It's now not happening at the time it was specified, but it will happen
later. Didn't happen this week, and that's really the point. Was absolutely Tony Burke's decision. Absolutely. The cabinet did not say to Tony Burke, you're not allowed to go to the National Press Club. That's what he means when he says he manages his own diary. It was Tony Burke's call. Although Tony Burke planned to go ahead, thinking that his cabinet submission would all be approved and he would go and do it. He's the one that pulled the plug on the basis that he believed some detail was not yet clarified. It needed a further meeting with the Prime Minister there, because I can assure you I have rigidage shorted up that people expressed that they wanted the PM to come back in that meeting to just get through that some of the contentious bits, right? And Tony Burke didn't.
That's some of the most fascinating bit, PK. Tell me more about that, because what does that tell us about how other senior leaders in the government see the need for Anthony Albanese's tick off an approval before taking on contentious policy change?
I'm going to share a hotline with you. This Prime Minister is at his zenith of power. We just saw it at the Labor Party conference, and we saw it played out spectacularly in the cabinet meeting. And I can assure you that there are many jokes going on in the Labor Party at the moment at senior levels about the PM needing to come and, you know, do the homework of people, basically adjudicate in some ways, because I even know what the contest is over. It's really about money. Like, people think it's all ideology, or it's too left-wing the policy, or not left-wing enough. Oh, no, the wings are really about money. As soon as you start stopping some people staying on their visas and you change the rules, they pay less tax. That has an impact on the budget. This is a money question, my friends. And that's the contest, because it has a budget hit.
And also the budget hit of reducing the migration rate, because economic growth in Australia has depended on migration for some years now.
Oh, yeah, and that's the growth of the economy.
Yes.
But this is actually money that you get from taxpayers. That's a big one. Mm. That's a big, big part of the whole that economic heads in the cabinet are not that into. They don't love that all of a sudden you lose a bunch of these people. There's less money in the kitty, if you like, during a time when the budget is under intense scrutiny, Mel, right? It has an impact on the budget bottom line. Less migrants, less taxes.
Less tax revenue, less economic growth. However, there are still the political imperatives behind the decision as well, which is to not be seen to being missing what is a forecast, but has sort of become a proxy target of the net overseas migration level. So this has still got to play out. And now that Anthony Albanese is getting his knees back under the desk, back from his holiday, this is going to be something that they are going to be revisiting over the next couple of days and weeks. Look, PK, the other issue that's really grown over the course of this week has been the national rules that the federal government's trying to put in place around how data centres use energy and what sort of energy they should use. So we've had the Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, make it clear following a meeting that was had of all the national energy ministers across all the states and territories that they wanted to ensure that all data center development would be powered by new renewable energy, that the data center developers had to go out and show that they were using either directly building new renewable energy themselves, or were willing to purchase certificates off future development of renewable energy. Now, this has really annoyed the Northern Territory and Queensland governments, who disagree with this policy. They want much more flexibility. They want to be able to utilise some of their resources like gas reserves to encourage data centre development in their jurisdictions. And the harder that Chris Bowen pushes with this, the more they push back. And we've certainly seen that, especially in the NT, where the Environment Minister there is saying, look, this is just huge overreach by the Commonwealth. Planning rules shouldn't be their thing. They shouldn't be stopping economic development in our jurisdictions. But Chris Bowen is saying he doesn't want to race to the bottom. This needs to be nationally coordinated, and he'll do whatever it takes to make sure that that everyone is compelled to follow the line here. So, PK, how do you see this being resolved? There's quite the standoff now. What's the way through?
Well, it depends if the Commonwealth wants to go nuclear, boom, boom, power, nuclear. Anyway, and, you know, federally intervene and be and really impose rules, and they can use carrots and sticks. You know, of course, the Commonwealth is a big funder of the states, as we know, so they have the leverage of money. So how is it going to go? Well, I think they're going to do a bit more negotiating, and there'll be a bit of an attempt at trying to find a medium of some sort. But ultimately, it sounded to me, at least from the words that Chris Bowen spoke, that they were prepared to play hardball in terms of intervention. Now, it's watch that space, but it's a really fascinating one because I think the coalition is trying to push this kind of, you know, their usual line, energy agnostic, you know, if you need to use gas, if you need to use this. But back to the social license of these data centres, I think the public, you know, don't, throughout the climate wars and all of the different sort of iterations of these various debates, I think renewable energy does still maintain a lot of public support. And people do think, well, if you're going to bring in these big foreign data centres, you know, don't go making things harder for us in terms of perhaps the environment and so forth. So I think the federal government is actually on pretty firm ground on this.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see Dante and the shadow minister at a federal level for energy very much push this idea that, oh, this is just Chris Bowen who's going to miss his own renewable energy target of 82% by 2030, and he's just trying to push and force these companies to help deliver his target. I think there's a couple of things here. I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of concern in the public about data centres and a lot of general public support for renewable energy, so much so that a lot of the data centre development that's already underway has been promoting the fact that they are actively choosing to be powered by new renewable or funding new renewable themselves. The question is, do you want to rely on that when push comes to shove in what's turning out to be a bit of a gold rush-esque move towards development at the moment? Does there need to be strict guidelines, or can you count on those data centre developers to choose to do that? And then we get back to this fundamental difference between the parties, in that ultimately the coalition has decided that there isn't an imperative to quickly reduce emissions. They support emissions reduction, but don't want to try and hit targets like net zero by 2050. So this really exposes some fundamentally different views about what our priorities are in policy setting between Labor parties, be it at a federal or state level, and coalition ones.
Exactly.
And PK, I think we have to mention one story, not happening in federal politics, but happening in a jurisdiction we don't always give a lot of attention to. And that's a story that's come from a cracking exclusive from the Canberra Times during the week about politics in the territory. And this is about the opposition leader in the ACT, Mark Parton, Coalition MP, Liberal Party MP. And the Canberra Times has published a story that shows an image from social media that is purportedly from a sex worker who had received an image, a photograph taken by Mark Parton during the ACT Legislative Assembly's equivalent of Senate estimates and estimates process, where he's said that his job is very, insert word, boring, and sent this to a sex worker. And the Canberra Times have got their hands on this. Now, this has led to a flurry of denials from Mark Parton. He says, look, he did send a text message saying his job was very something boring, but he denies that he sent it to a sex worker. He's now been questioned extensively about this. He's refused to say who he's sending the text message describing his job as boring to, saying, well, that's just private communications, I shouldn't have to say what that is. He's also denied that he's ever engaged with a sex worker, but has refused to answer further questions that relate to this. It's become quite potent in territory politics for a couple of reasons, I think, PK. One, there's obviously the salacious element of, is the opposition leader here really texting a sex worker while he's on the job in an estimates process? That in itself is enough to garner plenty of attention. But it's also kicked off plenty of discussion about, well, should the leader of the opposition, a significant politician, really be saying that a key part of his job is boring? Like, is that appropriate? Do we accept that all of us find parts of our jobs boring and that's just totally normal? Or is someone who's getting paid a very significant amount of money to play a really important role, leader of the opposition, should they really think their job is boring. And then it's also raised the question of, yet how many more scandals can the ACT Liberal Party yes. handle? Because I won't give you the full run through, PK, because that'll blow out our podcast time. But there have been many, and this is just the latest.
Yeah, look, so it's scandalous, let's be honest, this story, right? And that's why it's also very interesting. Can you think your job is boring? Well, I think so. I think you're allowed to think your job is boring. Having said that, if you seek high office, and let's accept that being the leader of the Liberal Party in the ACT is high office, but if we want to accept that, well, there's probably people who would find it more interesting, so maybe you should offer it up to someone else who thinks it's really interesting. I mean, I think Senator Smiths are interesting. I don't know. Like, if you think it's boring, do something else.
It was, he was sending text messages during discussion about elements that were direct to the shadow portfolio that he holds. So I think that sort of added to some of the frustration.
The whole thing is so hashtag embarrassment. Like, I'd be like dying. I would be like dead. How embarrassment. Should we do questions?
Let's do it.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah. Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for question time. Our first question comes from Gary.
I'm a regular listener and huge fan of The Party Room and Politics Now. I especially love your many well-informed guests. It's always so interesting to hear their different perspectives. My question is this. The Albanese government can point to achievements in areas like controlling inflation, actions to improve housing affordability, low unemployment, Medicare, renewable energy, and cost of living measures. Yet polling often suggests many voters don't credit the government for these outcomes. Is this mainly a communications failure, a policy failure, or simply that voters focus more on failures rather than successes? What could the government do differently over the next term to earn greater recognition for what it has achieved?
Gary, interesting question. Okay, greater recognition. Well, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder, right, whether you think they deserve greater recognition. Some people listening would think, actually, no, they haven't done some of these things well. And others, clearly including you, think, well, yeah, they've done some things really well and that story is not getting out. Look, I think if you look at some of the polling, like Redbridge last week showed that Labor holds a slight lead on cost of living, housing affordability and healthcare. So they are getting a little, like the voters might be frustrated and they're showing that in some other parts of the polling, but they can see that they've given it a red hot go, right, on some of these issues. They've tried to help on cost of living. But on your point, I will contest one thing, like this on controlling inflation. I think inflation is still a problem. I really do. You know, it's been very slow to get it down. And of course, people hold governments to account for that. So I think that's the broader problem, Mel.
Yeah, I think part of the, if we look at some of the issues that Gary's picked out here, and, you know, some of them you could probably argue either way, depending on what your political views are. But I think sometimes the problem that parties in government, whichever party they are, but when you're in government, you often don't get credit for where you succeed, and your success means something bad doesn't happen, because it's very hard to directly prove or show or remind people that, oh, if we hadn't done this, you might have suffered this really bad thing. You generally don't get credit for things that don't happen. You're much more likely to get credit from voters that things that are much more tangible, that tax cut or that hospital that was built that's in my area, they're much more tangible, much more likely to get credit for. And I think the Labor Party is factoring that into some of their decision making. I mean, I think the way we've seen staged tax cuts where small tax cuts come in regularly are a way to continually remind people that economic action has been taken in this particular area so that it's not forgotten down the track, so that the government isn't having to say at the end of the term, oh, well, if we hadn't done that, you would have had to pay more tax. Thank us for it now. They're trying to put it front of mind on a regular basis. And then some things like, I think the management of the fuel shortage has been perhaps an example of, the government would be absolutely kicked if there were lines of cars down the street outside petrol stations trying to get rationed petrol. But they have done a a good job of intervening in the market, providing extra financial support to ensure that there is a steady supply of petrol. And most people are probably going on their way, not really thinking about it. They're not thinking driving to work every day. Gee, great. Thank you so much, my government, for making sure I had petrol in my car today. That's what I mean by you often just don't get credit for things when they go well or when they might have gone worse.
Yeah, I think that's right. No one knows the worst, do they? Because they haven't lived the worst. And that's the all politicians will tell you that's one of the worst parts of governing, like the bit that people don't see, you know, the, oh, we did this thing and we avoided, I don't know, the GFC, the financial crash. But people will talk about the pink bats. You know what I mean? So they'll focus on that. That's fine. I personally, as a journalist, think it's our job to tell you the things that go wrong. But I can understand, as someone who watches the democracy closely, how frustrating it must be to not have the other side of that coin credited. Although I think sometimes we do credit. Like, I do think we try to.
Can I share a little anecdote from my colleague, please, Stephen Jedgetts, our foreign affairs reporter, who's excellent, who has said that he often gets variations of a complaint from diplomatic circles along the lines of, why haven't you written the story that says careful and slow diplomacy has delivered long-term gains in the nation's good? I think acknowledging that sometimes the nature of media is to look for where change is happening. That's more obvious where it's happening rapidly, be it good or bad. And long term is a bit harder to manage in the media cycle. So maybe look there, maybe there's a question for us in the media there as to how we look at things and how we report on them too.
Yes, yes. I don't know anyone who clicks on a story or wants to hear a story about slow and
patient
careful
diplomacy.
Patience. Okay, our next question is from Stephen. And here it is.
Stephen here, love the show. With an election due 2028, will there be a reshuffle in Labor? And if there is one, will they find a way to bring Ed Husic in or a different way to neutralise him? Love the show.
Okay. I'll give you my first take on this one. Ed Husic will not be brought back into the cabinet. There is no chance that Anthony Albanese will bring him back into the cabinet. I'm certain of it. Will it neutralise him if he did? I'm not sure if it would anyway. Like, I think he was always pretty outspoken even when he was in the cabinet. Like, he was, right? But, yeah. Anyway, I hope he's doing well, by the way, because he's had this accident, which we mentioned yesterday, and he's recovering at the moment. In terms of a broader reshuffle, Mel, I suspect there might be something.
I think there will be. I mean, the Albanese government has been remarkably stable in terms of ministerial portfolios and limited changes compared to previous governments going back some way. I think there would be. There's probably before you get to an election, there's always a bit of a natural attrition. Who's going to retire? Are there people who've been around for a long time and likely to be in cabinet or have ministerial positions that are going to retire? So I think there will be some changes. How significant they are, I think that's open to debate. We mentioned earlier that Anthony Albanese is really at the height of his powers over the party at the moment. But I think it's also interesting that he knows when to be hands off when it comes to factional issues. And a lot of issues around promotion and who is in cabinet and who is out of cabinet, who's in the outer ministry, those names are dealt with through factional issues. And he's shown he is happy to sit back, let the factions do their work, and make some decisions on personnel. But that's different from portfolio allocation. The Prime Minister decides, once you've got the individuals who sit in cabinet, the Prime Minister decides what portfolio they get. And that gives him huge discretion to make changes. So I think maybe we need to look into our crystal ball, PK, and go, well, let's just fast forward and assume that the current arrangement of cabinet that's in place now is still in place 6 months out from the next federal election. What changes do you think might be made? Do you want me to go first? I just threw you a curly one.
I'll say one thing. Okay, you've asked. I will go there.
Do it. Go
People
on.
People want that. Right now, I think Albanese's actually made it clear that he sees, 94-seat majority, a lot of particularly talented women. I keep getting told, look at Queensland, look at the sort of, there's a sort of group of people that they do want to promote. Like, that's the way it works. You want fresh blood, fresh youth. You know, like, you want to keep refreshing your team. They've seen what happens when you don't. And there are some, this often happens, who, you know, we're going to be, they'll be running for their third term at the next election, who you'll see may retire from politics. Now, you know, some people will deny it, but you know, I'm going to give you a couple of names. People talk about Chris Bowen being one, for instance. Now, he hasn't said he wants to leave, but yeah. Mark Dreyfus, he's not in the front bench anymore. They've already dumped him, but, you know, that's a seat that comes up. Like, there'll be movement is my point, and that provides, as they make announcements, the opportunity for the Prime Minister to then reshuffle, rejig, bring new people in.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I mean, there's sort of endless speculation about someone like Penny Wong, who's been in the Parliament for a long time in a lot of senior positions, and does she intend to, you know, continue to go? I'm not sure if she's up at the end of this term or not. But look, this is speculative, but to make the point that you would expect that before the next election, there would be a bit of a calculation done of who's intending to retire, who might not have performed as well in their portfolios as the Prime Minister might have hoped, and there might be some shuffling made ahead of an election. That's a good time to do it. I think the Prime Minister has shown that he values stability, and between now and closer to polling day, he's unlikely to make a shuffle unless there's a real need to.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yep, I agree with that. Okay, our next question comes from Cameron.
Pauline Hanson has recently made quite a thing out of attacking the free press in the National Press Club address, and more recently, ABC, SBS and The Guardian being banned from press conferences. Given that you yourselves host a show for the ABC, do you ever find it difficult to maintain neutrality when one of the largest voices in politics kind of wants you out of a job? What are you doing to ensure transparent media coverage when one side of politics is actively positioning themselves against the media?
Okay, Cameron, this is a great question. Just about, you know, how do you maintain neutrality? I'm going to give you an insight into the mind of a traditional journalist. I mean, there's all sorts of different journalists, right? But a traditional journalist, and this isn't just an ABC journalist. Most of you know I've worked across the media, right? Like, it's not the only place, although I've been here for a long time now. I can't explain how deeply entrenched neutrality is in our training from you know, university. Like, I've been in this industry for 25 years. It's like hardwired. And what I mean by that is people just, I mean partisanship and stuff. So I can cover Pauline Hanson and I'm not like, oh, she wants to defund the ABC. Oh, I feel such strong feelings. Like, I can't explain how overwhelmed I am with the ability to not even factor that in into anything. Like, I know people think that's disbelief or I know you must. No, no, no. You are right. Any journalist who tells you, oh, they don't have any views and we're some sort of Pollyanna moron.
Some blank canvas that doesn't have an opinion on anything.
I'm not thinking. Mm. No, I have values. I have broad ideas of, I think, good governance and fairness. But the idea that, you know, it's really difficult to somehow cover Pauline, I don't find it difficult at all. I cover it like any story. There's an emergence. Why are people interested? What sort of things is she saying? I do, however, have strong values. Values is different to partisanship, and I don't like any journalists being banned because I believe in the right of us to scrutinise all politicians. Doesn't mean I have any extra issue with Pauline Hanson. I think, however, that position is wrong, and we've said it.
Hear, hear, PK. I think you've said it very well. I mean, I actually think working in politics puts you in a better position than ever to maintain neutrality because you are constantly forced to engage with, discuss, interrogate, and consider a whole range of views on ideas and topics that you might otherwise never put your mind to. And I think that is part of the exercise of journalism, is to consider all of the ideas and factors at play, interrogate them all, try to understand them all. And you can internally completely disagree with something at a personal level, but still be able to interrogate an idea, understand it, try and explain it to people. I wouldn't have spent my working career at the public broadcaster if I didn't think the public broadcaster brought great value to the country. So I don't think it's any surprise to say that I support the work that the ABC does.
And it's continuing funding.
But I can absolutely understand and I do engage with people who don't think that there should be a publicly taxpayer-funded broadcaster competing with commercial media entities who are struggling in a transforming media environment, that might question how much the private sector versus the public sector should play a role in provision of media. Like, these are all very reasonable arguments for people to make. Our job is to interrogate those ideas, help explain those ideas, and people will go away and make up their own minds. And so, likewise, I don't have any trouble engaging with ideas that might be seen to attack or to undermine the very job that I work in. That's fine. This is a taxpayer-funded entity. It should be up for scrutiny and debate like any other. So I think the neutrality question for us is not really an issue, PK. No. I think the broader question of when you have political players who are sort of actively positioning themselves against the media, as Cameron put it, that's a bit of a different question, because we have to consider how we operate in an environment where, for example, One Nation wants to block organisations like the ABC or The Guardian or The Age, as we've seen in recent times, from attending press conferences, for example. That creates questions that we need to grapple with in terms of how we practice what we do, how we make sure we still fulfill that objective of trying to get the information, explain the information, if even getting the information is a struggle in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think a lot of people really struggle with this concept of understanding, which I think is why this is such an interesting conversation, neutrality. And the concept of neutrality is often contested as well. Like, you know, you're not really neutral because, you know, the basis of which you position from is a particular position of lived experience. All of these they're very intellectual arguments, you know, you have them in sort of university tutorials, and people should be having them, and you should always check where your neutral position comes from. You know, is it, where is that frame? Where is that positioning coming from? All of that should be interrogated, or absolutely. But I just think that, ask public servants. I mean, I've had friends who are deputy secretaries of big departments who might have personal views, but mate, they never bring it into, you know, they independently assess the policy based on the metrics that they're meant to deliver and all of the factors involved. Like, it's not that hard. And for me, the biggest one I've ever done, and I've talked about this publicly before, but I think it's important for people to get it, was the gay marriage debate. Like, I am very super gay and very happy about that. And I personally thought it was a no-brainer. However, I understood that the public had a right to have a debate about it. And I didn't feel it was very hard at all to be neutral in my treatment of people having that debate during that time. It was really very natural for me because I like debate and I think people should be having it and people should come to decisions, you know, fairly and be able to hear all perspectives, right?
Yeah, I think the analogy here that I like to return to when I am thinking myself about where am I sitting in this when I'm approaching this information and trying to explain it and where it sits, as you said, checking in on our own values and positions that we bring to look at this, is it's a bit like democracy itself, right? It's never perfect, but you need to be constantly vigilant and constantly striving towards the best possible version of it. There's no system out there that is the perfect democratic process. And I don't think there's any journalist out there that is perfectly unblemished in their neutrality and objectivity. But so long as we are constantly striving and checking in and monitoring and trying to improve how we approach issues to give it the best possible explanation and genuine engagement from all perspectives, that's what we need to be aiming for.
Yeah, I think that's right. Anyway, that was very cathartic. Thank you.
Oof, that was a big one.
All right, our next question comes from Vicky.
There is a lot of talk about One Nation not having any policies, and I got to wondering how political parties actually go about writing policy. In the case of One Nation, all the policies are new, and presumably Pauline can't write them all. So does she, for example, ask new One Nation member Colleen Harkin, who is passionate about education, to write the One Nation policy on education? And if a policy in the current Albanese government needs revising or updating, who does that? Thanks.
Policy, how do you make it? Look, there's lots of different ways to make policy. You can have a full process of white papers and green papers and public consultations and backbench committees feeding in and then discussion at cabinet level and then approval by the Prime Minister and the full bottle and dice. Sometimes you can just have a party leader stand up and say something and suddenly that's the party's policy. And then there's everything in between, right? There's no one way to do this. Policy can be made in a whole range of ways, and sometimes the quality of the policy also reflects the way in which it's done. So there's a full range. So how One Nation is doing it though, PK, that's probably another question. And I think that's actually quite opaque. I mean, some policies Pauline Hanson and her party and her colleagues have had for a long time. So there's certainly policies they have in place, not necessarily of a huge amount of detail, but policy positions that they have consistently held and argued for years, decades. But developing new policies, I think, is something that is being very carefully controlled centrally from what we have seen so far. Pauline Hanson and James Ashby, who's now the director of the party at a federal level in his new title, have made it very clear that they do want to retain centralised control of the party, that they're worried that as the party grows at quite an exponential rate, that could potentially cause issues from them. So I think the policy development we'll see going forward will remain quite centrally controlled. But it does bring up some issues around some. Well, how do you manage Victorian specific policy development when at the moment all the power is concentrated in people who are based in Queensland or New South Wales, and engage in federal politics?
Yeah. Look, I think the best thing you've said just in this answer is the opaque. Like, I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to know things I don't know. I don't know how they invent One Nation policy, but it looks to me like a party that is so deeply entrenched in Pauline Hanson and her identity that I don't think a lot happens unless it has her support, right? And, you know, in some ways, to be fair to Pauline Hanson, I don't think things get, like, supported by the Labor Party unless, particularly at his zenith of power, as I described it, Anthony Albanese gives it the tick off. I mean, we saw that with immigration this week, right? Like, few of the ministers going, look, until Albo comes back, not sure. There's another reason for that. I can't believe I'm going back to that, but I'm going to. They also trust his political instincts because he's often got things so right. So that cost-benefit analysis of cutting down migration versus, you know, the economic cost, like, they feel like he will get a radar. His radar will be right on that. That's the other thing. Anyway, she does have a lot of power. Clearly, you know, finding out what's going on in One Nation is hard because I think in some ways they do have a hostility with some parts of the media.
Look, and I think the other thing that's worth mentioning is it can be easier in this situation to develop policy when you have a small number of people or even one. So, you know, in the Victorian Parliament, they have Ricky Lee Tyrrell in the upper house for One Nation. So it's not hard if you just take one individual's position that sort of by proxy becomes their policy. I think it will get more complicated as the likes of, you know, Colleen Harkin, who's moved over to be a One Nation member and is going to contest the state election. When you start having more people involved, more people in positions, that does mean they need to be more concerted and more specific with the details of their policy. So I think this is very much a watch their space. But PK, before we go, Vicky did also ask about the Albanese government's process of policy development and if they want to revise a policy or an update a policy, who does that? Again, I think the answer to that simply is almost where we started, in that there are a number of ways to do that. The Labor Party does have very formal processes of caucus committees, backbench committees that do work in specific areas. They also have shadow ministers who develop policy and bring it through the cabinet process to formally develop policy. But it can also, so that's sort of the ground up way of developing policy. And we've seen even further back the grassroots of Labor's National Conference and grassroots members and union delegates feeding into a policy platform that influences policy. But we also still have top-down as well. The Prime Minister and the Cabinet can also make decisions that then filter down through the party. So there is no simple answer. I'm sorry, Vicky. There is no one prescriptive way of making policy. There are many, and there are pros and cons to the many ways of doing
for
it.
For sure. Well, that's it for the Party Room today, but keep sending your questions in because we love getting them. I like the voice notes. We've been very strong on the voice notes, which is great. You save me time from reading your questions. You can send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
But stay listening in the feed because David Spears is back with the next Insiders on Background episode on Saturday. He's speaking with the former Director General of the Australian Signals Directorate, Rachel Noble. So interesting to have a chat to a former spook at a time when there is a lot of attention on cyber activity. And of course, on Sunday, it's Insiders' 25th anniversary. So there's a very special show on Insiders on Sunday. I'll be on the couch for part of it. So do tune into that on ABC TV too.
Excellent. And I'll be back for Politics Now on Monday. So remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode. See you, Mel.
See you, PK.